Welcome to Living for the City. Living for the City is a program focused on telling stories from communities in New York and beyond. We cover issues that don't get the attention they deserve in the media. We're talking housing, the environment, social justice, and more. My name is Michael G. Haskins. I am the program host and executive producer. Jillian Jonas is the senior producer. We embrace the concept of Sankofa, loosely translated from the Twi language of Ghana, as it is not wrong to go back for that which you have forgotten. And on this day in peace and social justice history, part of the Sankofa moments that I bring you each and every week, October 22nd, 1963, 200,000 students boycotted Chicago schools to protest de facto segregation. In 1968, on this date, more than 300,000 protesters marked International Anti-War Day in Japan. The U.S. war in Vietnam and the ongoing, since the end of World War II, and massive American military presence on the Japanese island of Okinawa helped swell the ranks of the demonstrators. Nearly 1,400 were arrested. In 1979, on this date, the deposed Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, arrived in New York for medical treatment from Mexico. He received permission to do so from the U.S. government, which had installed him as Shah in a 1954 coup, despite warning from the newly established Islamic Republic in Iran, demanding that the Shah be turned over to them for trial. And finally, on this day in peace and social justice history, October 22nd, 1983, capping a week of protests, more than 2 million people in six European cities marched against U.S. deployment of cruise and Pershing nuclear missiles. 1.2 million Germans, including 180,000 in Bonn, a 64-mile human chain between Stuttgart and New Ulm and Hamburg, West Berlin, 350,000 in Rome, 100,000 in Vienna, 25,000 in Paris, 20,000 in Stockholm, and 4,000 in Dublin, plus 140 sites in the U.S. In London, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, CND, held its biggest protest ever against nuclear missiles, with an estimated 1 million people taking part. And that concludes this day in peace and social justice history, part of the Sankofa moments that we bring you each and every week, looking back in history to see where we've come from, to more clearly understand how we come to exist in this current moment, and to help us chart a course for the future. We'll be right back with our first guest in just a moment. Well, today on Living for the City, I have the incredible honor. Very, very pleased to be speaking with a true pioneer in the world of architecture, engineering, and construction. Cheryl McKissick Daniel is the president and CEO of McKissick & McKissick, the nation's oldest minority and woman-owned design and construction firm. With a legacy dating back over a century, Cheryl represents the fifth generation of this remarkable family business, which was originally founded by her great-great-grandfather, a former slave turned master builder. Under her leadership, McKissick & McKissick has continued to grow and thrive, managing billions of dollars in construction projects, from transportation infrastructure and schools to iconic landmarks like the Barclays Center and JFK Airport. She's not only a powerful force in a male-dominated industry, but also, this is key, a fierce advocate for diversity, mentorship, and breaking barriers for the next generation. Cheryl McKissick Daniel, author of The Black Family Who Built America, The McKissicks, Two Centuries of Daring Pioneers, with Nick Childs. Welcome to Living for the City, Cheryl. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you so very, very much. Cheryl, your company, McKissick & McKissick, has quite an extraordinary legacy dating back more than 100 years, well over 100 years. Can you share, just as we get started here, can you share what it means to you personally to carry that legacy forward as the fifth generation leader? What's that mean to you?
Well, it's actually 230 years dating back to 1790, when the first descendant of my family came here, and that was Moses McKissick the first. Mm-hmm. This legacy is God sent. That's all I can say, because the McKissicks went through slavery, Jim Crow, the prejudice of the Deep South, to build a business that is now standing five generations later. And so it means to me that I have a responsibility to carry this business with pride, with honor, and to make sure that it continues on. And so that has been what I have focused on in the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What are the lessons that were passed down, the lessons, the values to you from earlier generations of the McKissick family that continue to guide your leadership in the company today? What are those, some of those?
Well, you know, when we did the research and wrote the book, there were some reoccurring themes. Mm-hmm. The McKissicks lived off of five principles, and I call them four P's, perseverance, mm-hmm. preparedness, productivity, and purpose. I added the fifth, which is prayer. Mm-hmm. A lot of times when you are navigating through the business world, you definitely need prayer. Mm-hmm. But other themes that really stuck out to me is their ability to adapt but not conform to what was going on, not to lose their identity. And so many times they, you know, had to persevere through difficult times, whether it was getting their license in 1922, and, you know, conforming to the way business was done back in those days. And that's not just, you know, conducting business, right, and managing business. It's a culture.
Navigating all of that.
Yes, yeah. It's a culture. Yeah. And so But they never lost sight of the fact that they came from the Black community. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, they were always giving back, whether that was building churches at cost, mm-hmm. or bringing students in or teaching. Calvin McKissick taught at Pearl High. My grandfather, Moses McKissick, taught at Tennessee State. And so they were always mentoring and trying to lift up their community.
Mm-hmm. I want to pause here for a moment to let listeners know. And first of all, let me ask you, is it okay that I call you Cheryl? Let's start there.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. You know, I'm from a certain generation. You got to be careful about that. So I just wanted to make sure and check with you first. Very good. Excellent. Cheryl McKissick Daniel will be attending a moderated book signing with Charlemagne the God later today at Stavros Jakaros Foundation Library at 6 p.m. So that's the Stavros Niarchos, Foundation Library at 6 p.m. I wanted to let listeners know about that. And a little bit later on in the program, just before you leave us, we'll mention that again. And some other things that you will be doing. Very busy day today, I'm sure all of them are. There are several standard questions that I'm going to ask you about your book. But some of the family stories in this book, I'd really like to talk to you about. We're not going to be able to cover everything, but you know, when I heard you talk about a family tree that touched me very, very deeply, I loved how you focused on that part of the story even before you talked about building and what you had to do and what what the family had to do to create McKissick and McKissick. So let's talk a little bit about the early part of the book in talking about your family. Familiarize your family, your father, your mother, and how they were so instrumental in you and your education with your sister. And I mean, there's so much to talk about, your college years. I want to talk about that. Colleague that has left us and joined the ancestors now, Malachi McCord, has reminded me and others, when you talk about an individual's book, you have to say the name of the book. And I'm going to be saying that throughout our conversation. The Black Family Who Built America, the McKissicks, two centuries of daring pioneers. And my guest is Cheryl McKissick Daniel, and the book is with Nick Childs. Tell us about that, your family and your youth growing up.
Sure. So, you know, I started off earlier. Moses McKissick I came to this country as a slave in 1790. He was taught the trade of making bricks. His son, Moses McKissick II, was a brick maker as well as a master carpenter. And he actually incorporated the McKissicks. He was the first descendant to incorporate the McKissicks in Pulaski, Tennessee, right after emancipation. And of course, the backdrop of that is the Ku Klux Klan started in 1966 in Pulaski, Tennessee, where he was daring enough to open up his business. And then Moses McKissick III and Calvin McKissick moved to Nashville, Tennessee, and incorporated us in 1905. And that was before there were architectural licensing laws. The licensing laws did not go into effect until 1922. So now these gentlemen have been in business 16 years. Mm-hmm. And now if they didn't get their license, they were going to be put out of business. And if you can imagine two Black men going up to the courthouse to take their architectural license, what that looked like in Nashville, Tennessee. They were denied over and over again just because they were Black. They eventually lobbied the board, and they got one board member to get the rest of the board to agree to allow them to take the exam on the premise that they probably wouldn't pass.
Yeah.
And they passed, of course, the first time, and the board had to give them their license. And then the company was passed down to my father, William D. Barry McKissick, who now is the fourth generation. And he also was an architect, but had a construction company, and he was a developer. And then when he became ill in 1983, my mother had to step in and take over the business, which was a whole nother chapter for a woman in the 80s to take over the business. And so, you know, 230 years after Moses McKissick the first laid his first brick, the McKissick family still stands as a unshakable pillar of strength, resiliency, and ingenuity. And I find it interesting with where we are in America, back asking questions that we've already answered about equity, diversity, representation. And this story of the McKissick is both a mirror and it's a beacon. And it's a mirror because it reflects what Black professionals were going through for the last 100 years. But it's a beacon because it also represents what happens when perseverance meets purpose. So the Black family who built America has so much information in it, and it covers a lot of years. But because of Nick Childs, we were able to do that in a very interesting way.
Oh, you surely were. No question about that.
And we also somewhat make a case of how the McKissicks were able to stay in business so long, because the statistics are not in our favor. To pass a business down to the second generation is probably around 40% of businesses. And then to pass a business to the third generation is about 18%. And to the fourth generation is 3%. And here we are, fifth generation. And those numbers account for all types and races, right? When you talk about a Black business being passed down two or three generations, the numbers are even less. And so it is an interesting story. You know, the McKissicks were, well, architecture by itself is in a very elite field. You know, it was preserved only for the wealthy. And so when you think about the fact that the McKissicks entered this business, and this is long before diversity was a buzzword a corporate matter, right?
Quite right.
We're talking about really forging your way in, and you're the lone, you know, person doing it.
So you
started
out, you started out, the family started out early on with Black, working in the Black community, and then branched out to other places, but then had to come back to the Black community because during a time of Reconstruction, certain communities were feeling some kind of way about this progress that the McKissicks were making at that time?
Yes, that's correct. Well, initially, a lot of the Black businesses right after emancipation had a lot of white patriots because slave masters still needed the services they were providing.
And they directed their friends, the other people that they knew, toward the McKissicks because they knew they could do the work.
Exactly. You know, they were building these grand homes, you know, universities and colleges. And so the McKissicks were known for building, you know, very sturdy structures. And so, yeah, they were directed or they gained patrons from slave masters, previous slave masters, and their friends. But then during Reconstruction, and then we draw an analogy of the movie Birth of a Nation and the effect that it had on the mentality of white people and black people.
Just want to come to that right there. That's exactly where I was going. So, Cheryl, what is that? Explain that further for our listeners, because it was very poignant to me when I read that.
So Birth of a Nation was a movie that was released in 1915. And it depicted black people as murderers and rapists and, you know, insufficient. So this movie just swept across the country. It was, in fact, an economic energizer for Hollywood. And some say that, you know, this one movie helped to make Hollywood what it is today. This movie was actually aired in the White House. And it really told white people, if you're looking to endear black people, that's not a good idea. Do not do it. And scolded them for it. And then the white people who just out and out hated us and wanted to kill us, it gave them the license to kill us.
Do so.
So this is the impetus of, you know, the burnings in Tulsa and other black economic communities across, you know, the country in urban settings, basically. And so this had an effect on the McKissicks as well. And this is when the McKissicks had to turn to the black community to get their business. And so it's the imagery that has always been a problem. And it's as though, and we talk about this in our book, as soon as we make a little bit of headway as a black community, we're knocked back down because of insecurity. And I feel that we're feeling that right now. Again.
For sure. And you know, Cheryl, I've never heard it talked about, put forward in that way, that the Birth of a Nation, of course, I've heard about it for years and years, but I've never heard it quite put in those terms. It was an economic energizer for Hollywood, not just a film in the beginning stages, the beginning sessions of Hollywood, but an economic energizer for Hollywood. I think that's really extraordinary, and it's in this book, The Black Family Who Built America, The McKissicks, Two Centuries of Daring Pioneers. There's so much in this book. I want to talk to you about some of the photographs in this book. There's a picture of you and I think your sister in a wagon with Greyhound on. I have to talk to you about that because I have my own story about Greyhound buses, but maybe we'll have time for that a little bit later. But it's really, folks listening to this conversation right now with Cheryl McKissick Daniel, it is a really good read. I am so enjoying reading it, and one can run right through this book. So I encourage you to go out and get The Black Family Who Built America. Cheryl, building a business like this, like construction, like architecture, in a male-dominated field, male, no question about that. What are were and are some of the, well, maybe not are right now, but what were some of the biggest challenges you faced as a woman and a woman of color raising to the top of this space, which you are on some rarefied oxygen right now. So what were some of those?
Well, like you said, I mean, I can't tell you the number of rooms I've been into where I'm the only woman and definitely the only Black woman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times people feel that you have nothing to offer. They don't understand that you're leading a business and that you can lead. Sometimes they just act like you're not even there.
Wow.
And so forging your way in that environment, for me, it was great to have the legacy and the ancestors that I could think about and what their trials and tribulations were before I even hit the scene. And most of my professional career was in New York. And in New York, you know, tends to be have, well, at least it looks like it does. That's more open. But it just has to do with people aren't familiar with it. You're new. If you're in a room with 500 men and you're the only woman, and they've been knowing each other for years, you know, it's not really intentional that they're not speaking to you. It's just they're more familiar with each other. And so my mother taught me a long time ago that not to be afraid of telling my story to anybody. And so I would walk up to individuals in, you know, these networking events and in the galas and say who I was and what I represented. And, you know, some people wanted to hear it and some people didn't. But you only need a few to want to hear it. To give you the energy to move on and continue to tell your story to the next person and to support you. And so I found over the years that, you know, as I became familiar with the people that were my peers and they became familiar with me, that I developed the same respect and got similar attention. And, you know, really, at that point, you know, it didn't matter that I was a Black female. It was, you know, what are we talking about today? What project are we going after today? How can we bring, you know, more federal dollars to New York State? And so, you know, it has to do with familiarity, but it starts off with yourself first. You have to be comfortable in who you are and what you represent and know that you bring value in your diversity.
And family stories, how important in these spaces, how important were those family stories into grounding you and making you feeling like, look, I belong here. I come from a long line of fighters and innovators. Those family stories, were they, are they still important to you?
They are absolutely important to me. You know, not only did the McKissicks build buildings, but they built safe places for people like myself to understand and believe, you know, that we belong in these professional fields, even if the laws had not caught up to it, and even if the people around us didn't believe we should be there. They broke that mold, you know, 100 years ago when they entered in architecture. And, you know, their loudest protest was excellence. You know, they provided quality work, quality documents, quality structures and environments that people, you know, could thrive in. And so, yeah, their stories always get me through the day. And the other part of it is there was a lot of humor. Our family was very funny. There was a lot of humor in the stories that, you know, we got. And You know, sometimes you just have to laugh to release the stress.
Sure, sure. Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that you also champion, and I want to talk about in a moment, I want to talk about your work in Philadelphia and the contacts you made there before coming to New York and what you are able to create. But you're a champion of tax reparations as a means to address racial wealth disparities. Talk a little bit about that before we move on to some other very key issues.
You know, I can just see the difference between the McKissick business in construction that started in, well, Moses McKissick, I mean, yeah, Moses and Calvin started in 1905, and Turner Construction that started in 1902. Turner Construction is the largest construction company in America. And then if you look at, say, AECOM, which is a huge company that started within the last 20 years, and then you look at the McKissicks. So what is the difference between our companies? You know, why is it that the white firms are billions of dollars more than the black firms? And so I can see that, you know, we don't get to the fair break. We don't start at the same starting line as so many other white entrepreneurs. And yet we have built this country. You know, we have this slogan, our company slogan, who built this? We did. Mm. But it's not just the McKissicks who built America. It's all the black people that were collateral for Wall Street that built America. And so where is our 40 acres and a mule? What, you know, we totally were used to make this country great, but yet we did not receive anything for it. And so when I think about reparations, I don't think we will ever see a check from the federal government. Mm. But I do think it's possible that the federal government gives us the status that they give alien nations. And, you know, those are, you know, the Indian reservations and where they have the casinos. And, you know, they don't have to pay taxes. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I think a good reparation would be for black people who are descendants of slaves, that, you know, if it's not in perpetuity, but there is some extended period of time that we don't pay taxes so that we can build some wealth in our community.
Wow, that's quite extraordinary to contemplate. As you mentioned Tulsa a few minutes ago, and I'm thinking all of the struggles that the descendants of the Tulsa pogrom, the race riot that the many in the white community perpetuated on the black community there, it went on into this century to today. And the governors and people in Congress in that state, Arkansas, don't even want to acknowledge that today. So that's going to be something that's going to be a struggle, certainly into, you know, your daughters and their family's future, I'm sure. But nonetheless,
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, we are talking with Cheryl McKissick Daniel, the author, with Nick Childs of The Black Family Who Built America, The McKissicks, Two Centuries of Daring Pioneers. Cheryl, talk about your college years and how you started on this path toward engineering and architecture and some of your college life, because that's why I say the book is fascinating, because it gave me, as a reader, an insight to who Cheryl McKissick was at that particular time. You gave me laughs. I smiled throughout it. Thoroughly enjoyed it. That's why I'm suggesting that you go out and get this book, The Black Family Who Built America. So tell us a little bit about your college years and how you developed along the way, just a little bit.
Well, when I was growing up, we did not have the internet or cell phones. Let me start there. And yes, and what we did have was our community. And, you know, you as you were growing up, you were influenced by the people you were around, not the ones you see on a screen. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, our parents had a lot to say about what we pursued in life in the way of our educational majors and careers. And my parents always directed me into the architecture engineering field. And I went to a private school where a lot of the students were applying to Ivy League colleges and, you know, the Harvards, the Browns, the Yales,
the Stanfords, and all.
Stanford.
Your father said, "See, you can go to whatever school you want to go to, but I'm only going to pay for Howard.
I'm only paying for Howard." And you know, I didn't like that then, but it ended up being the best thing that ever could have happened. You know, arriving at Howard University in D.C. in those days, it was called Chocolate City. And so, you know, I'm coming from Nashville, Tennessee, an all-white school where, 75 people graduated in my senior class and six of them were Black, to a college that's pretty much 100% Black. And I'm telling you, it just blew my mind. I was amazed. And then at Howard, we had all the greats that would come in and speak to us. They were our teachers. It was just an amazing time. And then, let's see, Marion Barry was mayor of of D.C. So it was Black leadership. I just never seen anything like this in my life. And so to see all this Black excellence around me, to inculcate all of it, it creates a real sense of pride, a real sense that, you know, you can go out into this world and do anything. But remember, you're representing your community and you are representing Howard University, not Howard, not Harvard. Howard.
Howard. Well, some of the people that you saw along the way that you interacted with that, you know, came to back to Howard. Let's give you just a little bit of an example of what you experienced.
Well, I remember.
Hold on a second.
I was born in the Congo. I walked to the Fertile Crescent and built the Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine, perfect light. I am bad. I sat on the throne drinking nectar with Allah. I got hot and sent an ice age to Europe to cool my thirst. My oldest daughter is Nefertiti. The tears from my birth pains created the Nile. I am a beautiful woman. I gazed on the forest and burned out the Sahara Desert. With a packet of goat's meat and a change of clothes, I crossed it in 2 hours. I'm a gazelle, so swift, you can't catch me. For a birthday present when he was 3, I gave my son Hannibal an elephant. He gave me Rome for Mother's Day. My strength flows ever on. My son Noah built New Ark, and I stood proudly at the helm as we sailed on a soft summer day. I turned myself into myself and was Jesus. Men intoned my loving name. All praises, I am the one who would say. I sold diamonds in my backyard. My bowels delivered uranium. The filings from my fingernails are semi-precious jewels. On a trip north, I caught a cold and blew my nose, giving oil to the Arab world. I am so hip, even my errors are correct. I sailed west to reach east and had to round off the earth as I went. The hair from my head thinned and gold was laid across.
Cheryl, I'm going to bring it down now, but just reading that in the book, the kind of folks that came through that you interacted with, that you went to see either perform or talk with the students there, that must have been extraordinary for you back then.
Yes, absolutely. You know, like I said, all the great poets, authors, artists, you know, a lot of them taught at the university. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, you know, some of this I didn't even know growing up in Tennessee. I didn't know some of these people existed. Right. Now, I have to say, growing up close to the Fisk University, mm-hmm. you know, my mother, you know, interacted with Honor Bonthams and Langston Hughes, mm-hmm. you know, the John Hope Franklins and the J. Alexander Luby. And so we did have that rich, like, Harlem Renaissance environment mm-hmm. growing up in Nashville. But it just magnified when we got to Howard University.
I can imagine that. Now, Cheryl, you leaving the college and going into the profession and working closely with your father as the business was thriving then, and then you moved into Philadelphia before coming over to New York. And I'm mindful of our time here. You've been very generous, and I don't want to dominate this hour, but I so appreciate you being on this program with me today, a busy day, as I said, that you have ahead of you. Talk a little bit about Philadelphia and your experiences there in the industry.
So, first of all, I was in New York first.
Okay.
And I was in New York thriving under the Minority Women-Owned Business Programs in New York. Mm-hmm. And then Mayor Giuliani was elected.
Right.
And one of the first things he did was sunset the Minority Women-Owned Business law. And so opportunities were beginning to dry up, and that's when I decided to take the leap to go to Philadelphia.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And at the time in Philadelphia, Mayor Ed Rendell was running the city with David L. Cohen, and I was able to. There was a group of women who were in city council who really ran things and had a great relationship with Mayor Rendell and David Cohen. And that was Gussie Clark and Marion Tasco. And then Blondell Reynolds came later on. She was more of a protege of the two of them. And Janie Blackwell. And so, you know, I met these women one by one and began to develop relationships with them around economic business, black economics and business, and, you know, how construction created jobs and created businesses in the black community. And so they began to support me. Mm-hmm. And then what do you know? John Street becomes mayor. and so Philadelphia was a great learning ground for me, especially when it comes to politics and how politics can intertwine with business. And, you know, how these individuals were truly stakeholders in, you know, black empowerment. But a lot of times our politicians understand policy, but they don't understand how to apply that to business.
To business, yeah, right.
And then how to create an ecosystem, you know, for the black community to thrive. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I would spend my time discussing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, that's to say, McKissick is a key partner in delivering the $11.5 plus billion new Terminal 1 at JFK, leading design, construction, and community outreach. And that is extraordinary in and of itself. Some of listeners may not know that, but you know it now. But you were also, you provided the construction management for the $500 million, more than that, Atlantic Yards project, as well as the Barclays Center. Now, you know, when this Barclays Center was initially proposed, and I started hearing the name of Bruce Ratner, I didn't know who Bruce Ratner was. I knew his brother. I know, you know, the late Michael Ratner, because of his work at this radio station and the Center for Constitutional Rights, of course, but I didn't know about his brother. How did the project, particularly the Barclays Center, how did that develop? How did that evolve? Because I can imagine there was a lot of controversy around the Barclays Center with community groups and how you navigated through all of that and your contact and association with Bertha Lewis. Can you
yes.
give some insights about that?
Yeah, you are absolutely right. You know, I just happened to hear it on the news that Bruce Ratner was going to buy the Brooklyn Nets and build this arena. And I'm thinking, well, it's in Brooklyn. Brooklyn has a high concentration of Black people, although the Black people are from Caribbean descent and from all the islands in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And of course, that means not all of them get along. And so, even you know, and here I am, a Black American from the South. I'm not even from the Caribbean.
Right.
And so, you know, I just start going around telling my story and creating a vision of how this project could help the Black community, similar to what I did in Philadelphia. And in my travels and presentations is when I found out about Bertha Lewis. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I have got to meet this woman. This woman can make all the difference for me.
Yeah.
Because I knew Bertha was close to Bruce Ratner. Well, at the time, she hadn't become close. She was really one enemy, like a foe, because, you know, she was protesting his project.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And she wanted affordable housing. And eventually, because of that, Bruce brought her into his office and they began to develop a very good relationship. Because Bruce really is a good guy. You know, he really wanted to do what was best for his beloved Brooklyn. Because if anybody knew Bruce Ratner, they knew he loved Brooklyn. And he wanted to make Brooklyn, you know, as close as he could to Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Well,
as far as, you know, the skyline and an economic engine. And so, so Bertha, once she developed her relationship with Bruce Ratner, she took me along with her.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how we were able to get into this project. It's kind of like doing a massive marketing outreach strategy to meet as many people as you can till you get to the right person.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's how we were able to get on the Barclays Arena project. Now, you know, we did not build the actual structure, but we moved all the rail to make way for the structure. And that was a $300 million project.
Right.
We had to move the rail from a existing location to a temporary location while they were still trying to acquire the land for the permanent location. And it had to move to a temporary location to make way for for the foundation of the actual Barclay Arena. And so it was a fascinating project. And, you know, again, one of those projects that was a game changer for McKissick.
You know, Cheryl, I would hear back in the 1990s, I would hear about black construction firms. Certainly not on the level that you're at, but I would hear about them not getting a seat at the table, but not being able to work at all. I suppose this was during the Giuliani years. I imagine it was, yes. And going out of business altogether. How were you able to navigate through all of that? And again, I'm watching the clock and I'm just about out of time, but tell us about it. Had you heard that? Were you aware of that?
Oh, yes. I had, you know, associates who went out of business. Their work dried up. You know, if they were architects, you know, the lifespan of a business for an architect is during the design phase. So that's could be up to a year, but the construction lasts much longer. And so we had some very big projects at the time that we were working on that lasted longer than, you know, the architectural or design side of the business. So we were able to hold on, although our contracts did go down. It was very difficult to win new contracts. And like I said, as a result, that's why we retreated to Philadelphia. And then we came back to New York after Giuliani left. You know, and so, you know, that's my concern today with, you know, erasing these DEI programs. You know, what effect is going to have on black and brown businesses? You know, we're already seeing it in New York. Penn Station just came out, which is an Amtrak project to reconstruct and renovate Penn Station. It came out with zero minority women-owned business goals, no service disabled veteran goals. And, you know, that's detrimental. But I can say that, you know, the firms that are thinking about the future, understanding that the pendulum will swing in the other direction, they are continuing to reach out to firms like ours and keep us in the loop and keep us, you know, involved with the current opportunities that they're on.
Cheryl McKissick, Daniel, we are out of time. What in the last couple of minutes, what's your vision as you look ahead for the future of McKissick and McKissick?
Well, you know, I just want to make sure that I grow the company. With each generation, the company has grown. And I'd like to make it sustainable in every way that I possibly can so that it will last, you know, another 100 years.
And you have two daughters that I've seen in the book. Didn't even get a chance to talk to you about the Greyhound wagon and my own story of Greyhound, but maybe if I get to meet you sometime, we'll be able to just talk to you a little bit about that. The book, again, is The Black Family Who Built America, The McKissicks, Two Centuries of Daring Pioneers, Cheryl McKissick Daniel, with Nick Childs. You have been so generous, Cheryl. I really appreciate that. And how can people find out more? Is there a website or something that people could find out some more information or to buy the book and how they can do that?
So books are sold. The book is sold anywhere their books are. You know, Amazon, Simon & Schuster, Barnes & Noble. And we have a website. It's at CherylMckissick.com. That's McKissick.
All right. Well, Cheryl McKissick Daniel, thank you so much again for being on this program, Living for the City, with me today. And don't forget, folks, that Cheryl will be attending a moderated book signing with Charlemagne the God later today at Stavros Nicharos Foundation Library at 6 p.m. So check that out. And then there's an upcoming book signing on November 1st at Nicholas Brooklyn Bookstore. So a lot going on this week and into next. Cheryl, thank you so much for being on the show.
And if I could add, that's the free library. I mean, not the free library. That's the Fifth Avenue Main Library in New York.
The Fifth Avenue Main Library, they put that down.
It's on Fifth Avenue. Yeah, it's
the Fifth Avenue.
Yeah.
Okay.
The main library.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'll make sure to mention that again tomorrow and through the rest of the week. Cheryl, thank you so much.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Cheryl McKissick Daniel here on WBAI spent the entire hour with us, and I appreciate that so much. The Black family who built America, the McKissicks, two centuries of daring pioneers. I'm Michael G. Haskins. Now, as we are in the crunch now, under the tyranny of the clock,